I just started watching How to Get Away with Murder.
Oh, ooh, me too.
Baby, it's me so too. Good.
I watched the entire first season, and I've been watching the second season.
I only watched the first four so far.
Okay. It really picks up. I mean, it's good from the beginning. Yeah. No, the pilot, I mean, Shonda.
God, we got some good questions.
Shonda's like weakness has never been starting out a series. Like she starts with
interesting.
Her whole, and this is like, I'm really sorry. I'm not trying to throw shade at Shonda, but her whole like deficit comes, I think, like in a third or fourth season.
But do you think part of that is because she's now like an institution and it's because she's not holding on to that? Like she
perhaps.
Can't, there's no way that she's involved with Grey's Anatomy anymore. Right?
No, she hasn't been for years, but I will
and
say,
I would
like,
even say Scandal, she has to have walked away from when How to Get Away with Murder started.
Yeah, but How to Get Away with Murder only started a year ago, and Scandal, I think people said it started jumping the shark third season, and
I
agree with that.
Is this one writer that everyone is like kind of
Shonda Rhimes?
I guess I don't know. I've heard that before, but I've always missed.
She's
the
not
reference.
Like to call her a writer is an understatement. She's an empress.
Okay. Yeah,
she's
so
an empress.
She's, yeah,
so she's written some seminal TV shows.
Mm-hmm. Seminal, full of seminal
she is,
fluid.
She
That's
is the only
I know,
person.
Just whenever I hear that,
she's the only person consistently producing appointment television.
What's appointment television?
It's like a TV show that like you want to watch when it fucking airs because you're not going to DVR and get to it over the weekend.
Oh.
You want to watch it now. You make an appointment to watch that show.
Really?
Yeah. I think that's true. I think it's so great.
So like,
that's really cool.
But, yeah. But what about a? I don't understand that. So you're saying like you wouldn't DVR it and watch it later? Like you have to watch
you
it
You
want to
watch
happens.
It live. Because it's like, it's also something that's like, it's going to blow the fuck up on Twitter.
Oh, so
like,
that's what it is. So you don't want to like.
Well, you're going to get spoiled.
And also like, you don't want to wait to find out the stuff that you're going to find out.
Right, because as soon as one episode ends, you're like dying for the next one.
Yes. Mm.
Can I tell you a TV show that I'm dying to see?
Yeah.
You guys seen this, The Man from High Castle on Amazon?
Oh, no, it's based on the book, right?
Yeah, the Philip K.
What
Dick
is that?
Book.
Philip K. Dick,
it's
yeah.
about, it's this world where it. Like Germany and Japan have won World War II.
Oh,
and then
God.
Very quickly turns into a very cool sci-fi. It's like I watched the pilot.
Philip K. Dick is like a alternate reality.
He's a sci-fi.
Dude.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. But it's really good. And it comes out November 20th. But I literally watch the pilot and I like dream about being in the world where I'm running from Nazis in America.
Whoa. That I mean, that's
it has a crazy vibe that is like really
it must
cool.
be like evocative.
It's very cool. What were you going to say about me, Nicole?
Just you, we dream about different things.
And that is a long form conversation. Recorded at UCB Comedy Studios in New York City. This is the Long Form Conversations Podcast with your hosts, Sean Diston and Nicole Dressbell. Hello, nerds. How are you? My name is Sean Diston, and I'm here with my co-host, Nicole Dressbell. How are you?
I'm well, thank you, Sean.
And this is the Long Form Conversation Podcast. Guys, we're back. Sorry, I think we've had a week off. We've missed an episode, but we're going to try to make up some time. But we have an amazing guest here today. Nicole, I feel like you should do the introduction on this one.
Why?
Because, I don't know, you guys are like, you work together and you have like an intimate. All right, I'll do it. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Joanna Bradley, one of the funniest improvisers around. Someone who, when I took a class with her in 2010. Oh, do you look it up?
No, I just have a very
just
good memory.
Great memory.
Ooh, great.
Well, that's going to be great for the podcast. In 2010, I remember not knowing who she was and immediately after the first class being like, okay, this person I'm in competition with. I just remember
Jesus
feeling
Jesus Christ.
Cool. Just because you were so funny in a way that I couldn't do. Joanna Bradley, I would say one of a kind, amazing, sketch actor, has put up great shows at the theater, part of Improvised Seinfeld and The Seinfeld Show, on Maude Night, on Harold Night, now on the weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, Joanna Bradley.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much.
That was a great introduction. You can't spring
that,
was
really
that on
good,
me.
Sean.
Normally I do the introductions, right?
I think
we took a week off and I'm just all thrown.
Yeah, if you spring it on me, mine's just going to be feelings words. Yeah, mine will just be like
I know enough. I've listened to this podcast enough to know that feelings words are frowned upon.
Yes.
Yeah, we
exactly.
try not to have
exactly.
feelings.
Yeah,
we try not to have
my, if I had to do an introduction, it would just be like a mood board of like how the idea of Joanna Bradley makes me feel.
Well, it's just funny because I think
it's wonderful.
Right before we started the podcast, I just realized how much you guys have worked together because I didn't realize. Is it not that much?
Yeah. Did you guys? I think we literally the only thing we've collaborated on and not. It was the your Hillary thing.
Yeah.
Which wasn't even a collaboration. It was just me acting in your thing that
you
wrote.
Didn't do yeah. women. What was the stuff with Caitlyn that the web series?
Vag Magazine?
Vag
no.
Magazine.
That was before my time.
Oh, I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Time. I mean, it wasn't before I like was around, but it was before I was around enough for any one of those girls to know who I was.
Interesting. Interesting. Yeah. Well, anyways, thank you for being here, Joanna.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. It's a really good podcast.
Thank you. You've listened, so I think you know how these things start. Nicole, how do they start?
Hey, Joanna, before you took your first class at UCB, who were you? Where were you?
What were you doing? And what were you doing?
Whoa. That was a premature edit, Sean.
Well, the bit is that I never say it with Nicole, so it's funny.
That was great. Oh, my God.
Who were you? Where were you? And what were you doing?
Well, as Hartney pointed out, I was me, and that's so strange. A question to ask. But so I was me and I was here. I had just graduated from college and I had moved back to New York City and I was working at a very fancy, large white shoe law firm in Midtown that subsequently gone bankrupt.
What does that mean? What does white shoe law firm mean?
White shoe is like an old school law firm. Like this law firm was started partially by Dewey, the presidential candidate. Like it's that old.
Oh, wow.
It was originally called Dewey Ballantyne. Then it merged like the day after I was an employee there with another big law firm to become Dewey and LaBeouf. And it has since had like so many articles in the New York
Times.
So it's
not just a like... That's like terrible. Like a law office. It's like a
big
old school law
full of
office.
Like on Fridays the male lawyers wear like blue blazers with gold buttons and khakis. Not as a joke.
Because they're gonna leave and get right on their boat.
They're gonna get, exactly.
Wow. Yes. Why were you there?
I was there because my plan was to go to law school. And I went and that's like kind of what you do. Like you go, maybe not for everyone, but you go, you be a paralegal legal mm-hmm. assistant, which is what I was. And then you take the LSATs, which is what I did.
And wow. What derailed you?
What derailed me was...
Because this is just a break, right? This is just a detour?
Yeah, you're still going back to law. You're still going back to practice.
Yeah, this is just like a... This has been a... What is it now? This has been a 7 or 8 years. This has been an 8-year detour. This is honestly murky for me. I remember when it all happened, but I don't remember why... Something clicked. I remember that I was going ahead and doing it, and I had never considered any kind of creative profession because it just seemed like silly. Like in the world that I came from, that was kind of like pipe dream silliness.
So you were never in like school performances or did any sort of acting before?
No, I never did any acting. I did do music. Right. Like in high school, like I sang jazz and I played jazz guitar and I did music in college, but it was always very much like, this is just like a thing you do while you're young and while you have fun. Like you cannot pursue an artistic career. That's like for, I don't know. It just wasn't.
You kind of lived in my head like, oh, it'd be a very fun like TV show to see. Joanna Bradley, who went off to go be an actor for a few years, have to come back and do law. But isn't
yeah,
that
it's like
what
the Good Wife, except I wasn't being a mother. I was being a comedian.
You're being a comedian. But then there's that show with Rob Lowe now where he's like an actor gone back to the...
Is that what Grindr is about?
Yes.
Not quite.
What's I don't that? Know. Well, what they've sold me in the commercials is that the Grindr is this guy who played a lawyer on TV who went back to his family's practice.
Yeah, you're right. That's what it was. I don't think he's like, trained.
What? He's not a trained lawyer.
Well, he's not a trained lawyer.
No, but so his brother is a
his
lawyer.
His brother is, so it's
and there's
hilarity
tension.
Ensues.
Yeah, well, you don't learn much at law school. I think it's definitely enough to be related to a lawyer and have played one on TV.
Yeah. Interesting.
That's sufficient.
That makes sense.
Holy shit.
So how did George Karaman factor into your life? Wait. Right, because I'm wondering if that's part of what
he
eventually
was not
gets
on my radar then. We took a break of like knowing each other, not in any intentional way, but we went to high school together.
Right, and George comes from a family of artists.
George comes from a family of like serious actors. His dad was like the right-hand man. His dad's Fred Karaman, right-hand man to Meisner, as in the Meisner. And his dad was the guy that Meisner was like, I'm going to teach you how to teach Meisner technique so that you can keep teaching it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but George was, he didn't do any acting or anything in high school either.
Oh, interesting.
He was a jock.
What kind of high school did you go to?
We went to a little Quaker school on 16th Street called Friends Seminary. I went there my whole life. George came in high school, I believe. And there was that stuff. Like, there were people who did it. But I don't know. I don't think...
You're from, like, a salt-of-the-earth, hardworking New York City people.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't... Like, salt-of-the-earth is maybe a little bit...
maybe, like... Cement of the concrete? What is the city equivalent of salt-of-the-earth?
Yeah.
Puke of the street.
Yeah, puke of the street. Yeah, from the puke of the street.
The puke of the street,
you scrape the puke up. It's good enough. You don't need your own new puke. You use the puke you find on the street.
That's
right?
So funny. I mean... But what I think is interesting is that you truly don't have the moment that was like, this is why I'm going to, was there?
No, it was like this. This is what I remember. This is how I can explain how the turning point happened. My older sister, who was very type A, was like straight A's, went to Stanford, was a big deal, and then went to medical school at Yale. She, and I was like, I wasn't doing arty stuff really, except for music and stuff. But I wasn't, like, I was kind of the fuck up. Not really. I got good grades, but they
weren't
like her.
An insane scale. You were technically a fuck up.
Yeah, compared to her, I was a fuck up. So she then, so it's my first year at Dewey and LaBeouf, and I'm 22, I guess turned 23. So
that's an insane name for a law firm because it sounds like a Dewey and LaBeouf. Morty show.
Yeah.
Yeah. You are listening to Dewey and LaBeouf.
Dewey and LaBeouf. 95.7. Dewey and LaBeouf. Yeah, so I'm there, and then she... This is what happened. She started going to see UCB. She became obsessed with the Stepfathers. She started going to Stepfather shows all the time. And she would come home and like recount them to me, literally like recount the improv to me, which she was weirdly good at doing. And she was like, it's such a great place. It's so cool. Then she saw that, you know, that Chicago group, the Too Much Light Makes the Baby Go Blind people.
Yeah.
So she saw that show. She was like, she was like, man, the show is so cool. They hold auditions for people. You should audition for it. And I was like, huh. And it just, she said it to me, and we had this exchange where I was like, oh, okay, yeah, that sounds good. I would like to do that. And I looked into it, and they were like, you should come see a show first. I went to see Too Much Light Makes a Baby Go Blind, and I thought the funny stuff was really great, and I didn't like the other avant-garde stuff. And I thought, maybe I should start thinking about doing funny stuff. And then she said to me, my sister was like, you should audition for, if you like funny stuff, you should go audition for UCB. And I was like, yeah, I should. I should just roll up there and audition. Had no idea. Had
so you
no
didn't know
idea.
There was like a school or?
No.
Okay.
I had no idea. I knew, like, I seen him on TV, and I went one time at the old theater when I was like 16. A friend of mine took me. But I didn't know any of that stuff.
So at this point, you decide I'm going to go roll up an audition for UCB. You haven't even seen a show. You've just heard about a lot of shows.
Yes, and I don't mean to say that I then went to wherever they were holding auditions and stood in line. I don't mean
and
to say
that.
And then
she got
no. But,
right.
I thought
but
to myself,
in your mind, you're
my
starting
mind,
to think you're going to do this.
Yes, because I think I had that pass from my sister who was like a very reasonable, rational person.
Right.
Rational person and who had always steered me right. And she was like, I think you should do this. And as soon as she said it, it felt
so wait,
really
she
good.
Didn't think she should do it. She thought you should do
yeah,
it. So
yeah,
she
yeah.
must have seen some sort of, you must have been a funny person to your sister.
I always thought that I was funny the right. way that like all my friends were funny.
Right.
And all my friends now, all my friends who are doctors and own art galleries and are, you know, whatever the fuck, they're really funny. Mm-hmm. But I thought I was funny like that. And I didn't, you know, I think that sometimes when, I don't know if you guys ever get this question from, I guess we can call them civilians.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll say stuff like, man, that's so hard. I cannot imagine doing what you're doing. Like, I could never do what you do. And I always want to, I say to them most of the time, like, I actually think if you wanted to, you probably could. If you are funny, like if I'm hanging out with you, you're probably funny.
Yeah.
And if you really wanted to do this badly, like, yeah, you could.
I
think the bigger thing is like, we can't do anything else. I can't. Like,
because of a lack of, like, functionality?
A little bit, or just, like, lack of the discipline to do something that doesn't feel constantly rewarding.
Well, I
like,
don't know.
That's interesting.
That's maybe. Possible, but I also think it's one of those things where when I saw improv the first time, I don't think I had the thought of, there's no way I could do that. I think I immediately thought, like, I could probably figure that out.
Me too.
That's what makes so, improvisers.
That's what I think it is. I think it's some people just have that block of like, oh, I could never figure that out. But for whatever reason, I saw improv, and even as crazy and as amazing as it was, I remember just being like, I guess I could kind of get the logic.
Yeah, it's arrogance.
Yeah, I mean, it's a blind arrogance.
It's a blind arrogance, but it's also a desire to like to chase that.
Yeah.
For some reason, despite the constant failure.
So that's very interesting. You know? So you then roll to UCB, discover that there are classes.
Yeah, I think I went. I think I like in the midst of this kind of like put that on the back burner. I saw one ASCAT show. I remember. I'll be honest, it was underwhelming. I don't remember anything about it except that I remember that Ian Roberts said. Specifically spent a long time talking about how Amy Poehler wasn't there. And he said to the crowd, you're so unfortunate that she's not here, as cute and as funny as she is on TV. She's so much funnier in person. I remember that and being like, huh.
Interesting.
Okay. And then I don't remember it. Then I just went online and the first class I took was a sketch class. Because that also seemed, I did not plan to do improv.
That's so interesting. What drew, like, what made you pay 400 or whatever much
money? It was like 350 back then.
It was like 350, but you were like, well, I'm going to, it's so interesting.
Was it that sketch still seemed comparatively academic?
Probably.
Yes, and vocational and grounded.
Yeah.
And improv seemed like, oh, what do you want to be on stage? You want to be an actor? What do you want to be? People look at you?
So when you're signing up for the sketch class in your head, you're like, this might take me away from doing law? Or did you already hate law?
No, I didn't. I didn't hate it. I was doing really well there, and I had become accustomed to. Even though I was low on the totem pole there, I had become accustomed to the sort of like beautiful, sweet life of a very, very nice law firm. Like I could see that the people higher on the totem pole around me were living a very nice life.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, I could do this. I could roll up in the morning in a black car, earn $175,000 at. Age 27,
pay your dues so you can kick your feet up.
Have my like beautiful office where I look down on Sixth Avenue. Yeah, I could do that. And so I think that it was very comfortable. But I think I started doing it. Like this is so weird, but the only thing I can compare the feeling to is like the same as the feeling of like coming out when you're gay, where you just like start to dabble.
You were like exploring
and get into it, but you can't say to yourself yet, like I'm doing this.
Wow.
You just like, you know, it feels good.
So you came out as a performer basically later on in life.
It took a while, yeah.
That's so interesting. So you signed up for the sketch class. What was the experience like coming to classes in the beginning? Like, were you instantly hooked or were you taking breaks between classes or?
No, I was pretty instantly hooked. I mean, I don't think I took the sketch class and went like, oh my God, this is incredible. Right. But I definitely thought like of all the classes I've taken in my life, and I liked being a student, a regular student, but of all the classes I've taken in my life, I was like, oh, this is like, I want to do my homework and I want to take criticism and I want to like really listen to my teacher who was Charlie Sanders. Mm-hmm. I also remember hinting at, because that's such a weird way to start at UCB, like not an improv.
Yeah.
Like I could feel the rest of the UCB world kind of like filling in around me because there were people in class like John Murray was in my class.
Right.
And he and Charlie Sanders would talk about stuff like about UCB in general in class a lot. And I'd just be like, whoa, this place, like there's a lot more going on than like this class.
Right, yeah. Oh, that's so interesting.
So then what was your pacing after that?
I took that class. And I think right after I took Sketch 201 with Michael Delaney, where it became increasingly clear to me that this would be a whole lot easier, this writing thing, if I had any improv. So then I was like, I should take an improv 101 class just to learn the basics. Because I didn't know, you know, like beats and game. Like they teach you that in sketch, but
it doesn't get drilled as much as when you're doing it in improv.
Yeah, it can't possibly because you're not up on your feet living it. So, excuse me. So I think then that summer, then I signed up for first Improv 101, which was supposed to be with Bobby Moynihan, but then day of, Gil Ozeri showed up and he was like, yeah, hey, I'm coming for Bobby. Bobby booked something. He didn't say that it was SNL. So that was August 08.
Did you at that time see any shows that were like, oh, this is like any super inspiring shows, or were shows a part of keeping you here? Or was it?
Yeah,
just...
I started to go to weekend shows because again, my sister was so into Stepfather, so I just started going to Stepfather shows, and I was like, oh, fuck. this is the jam.
Yeah.
Then I started going to Harold Knight immediately, obviously, when I was in 101. And I was the kind of like, I was the kind of audience member where I just thought everybody was great. Like, I really thought all the teams were great mm-hmm. and everyone was doing a fantastic job. And they
you
were
hear
stars.
Us talking about all these teams on the podcast and they're just like, well, we didn't think it was working. You're like, I love that.
Yeah.
Team.
I'm just like, what? Yeah. Like, I don't even remember. Like, I'm trying to remember. Like, Bastion was definitely one. I mean, but they were really good.
What year was this?
So this is 08. So I remember specifically, yeah, like, Bastion had just survived another shakeup
so
when
then
I started.
So there was, like, Hornado.
Hornado!
That was the fun
yeah.
team name.
Ragnarok.
Ragnarok. The fucking Kennedys.
The fucking Kennedys I remember very distinctly.
Yeah.
I remember one night seeing Ben Schwartz roll into Harold Knight. I was waiting on line, and I saw him roll into Harold Knight, hold, like, eating a big slice of pizza. And I remember just being like, I must have already started performing by then because I remember being like, how can he eat before he goes on stage? I was just like, how? He's so calm.
That's
he's
so
like
funny.
Running in to do his show and he's chatting with people, eating a big slice of pizza. And before every show, I feel like I'm going to shit my brains out and faint.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
That is so funny. So do you have any moments from that? Like, did you have any moments in the like, core curriculum where you're like, oh, did you join an indie team or did you like sort of step up that improv obsession at any
yeah.
point?
Yeah, I so I did 101, 201, so 101 with Gil Lazzari, 201 with Ari Vukitis, and then 301 I took with Gavin, and I met like a lot of people in there who I met Michelle Wolf there.
Mm-hmm.
Then I met Spencer Griffin there, and I think Fox Walton, who no one will remember because he's like a millionaire banker now.
Fox
Walton. Do you guys remember Fox Walton?
Tall, kind of handsome, blonde hair.
He was handsome, blonde hair from the South.
I think I like coached him two or three times.
That very charming.
Super familiar.
Very charming, very funny guy. Was already like a big time banker at Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
And like 30 years old and was just like a very naturally funny dude who loved comedy, but was obviously never going to pursue it as hard.
Right.
Was he Southern? Where was he from?
Yeah, he was Southern. He's from North Carolina or something. South Carolina. So I met those people, and we formed the Makeouts, which was me, Spencer Griffin, Jason Tottenham, Michelle Wolf.
Jason! I fucking miss Jason.
David. Oh God, I'm forgetting David's last name.
remembered his first name.
There's a million.
David. And Fox, the six of us.
Wow. Interesting. And was that like was that something where you were like starting to spend, like, because you're doing your job at the same time, right?
Yeah.
So you're working long hours at the law firm?
Yeah, I didn't leave that job till June 2010, and I got fired. I didn't leave it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Was it because you were doing too much outside stuff?
I wish. No, it wasn't. I mean, it doesn't. It's not interesting enough to talk about,
right,
but it's
right.
It's not. I messed up, but it's not like you wouldn't hear it and be like, ooh.
Yeah,
it just
yeah.
was stupid.
It's just stupid. Yeah, I get it.
But anyway, yeah.
But at that time, are you starting to be? Because I remember I had my day job deep into my improv career, and I remember there were just points where I was like, this is no longer a thing for me. Like, I've transitioned out of working here,
yeah.
basically before I left.
Yes, I think by the time we formed the Makeouts, I was like, yes, I want to do this.
Yeah, because that seems like a big step for you, especially if you started taking improv classes thinking, I'm just doing this to supplement my sketch classes, which is a very practical thing I'm doing. Starting an indie team is not at all practical.
No,
that's
it is
like
not.
Pure love.
Absolutely. And then, like, hosting shows, like, because we hosted a show for a long time at that place, Gotham,
it's me, probably.
Whatever. Mm-hmm. I feel like you, Boys Club for
we
Men.
We did a show there. That's why I
did
remember.
A couple shows
I remember that team, and I remember this Fox guy.
Yeah.
I totally remember him, but I can't, like, picture his face. But I remember, like, being like, this guy doesn't belong around here,
yeah.
but he's doing it. but, yeah, you know what I was going to ask is, and I've maybe talked to maybe Don about this, but I think that lawyers, for the most part, that skill set of being able to become good at being a lawyer, I think probably lends towards being good at improv.
The skill of, oh, like if you were good in a courtroom, you would maybe also be good at improv?
I think so, but I think specifically, and this is very technical, but like applying case law to like other
yes.
like applying one thing to another situation almost like
yes.
this well, is a second beat of this
analogies.
Thing. So, yeah, yes. basically analogies. So yes. this is a second beat of this, so it can't be, you have to treat it the same way.
Yes.
So I just think, I don't know, I've always thought like, man, if we just got like a room full of lawyers and tried to teach them game, they'd probably be really, really good.
Isn't there? There's a lawyers only class.
I think there
class.
Was a lawyers yeah. only class that Finelli taught, is why I asked him about yeah. it. But yeah, did you feel that at all? Did you feel like a natural sort of connection to game?
Yes, I did. I didn't feel, and the disconnect was, I understood it immediately. It made complete sense to me.
But you couldn't
but
do it.
I couldn't do it, which
that's
is like,
everyone's, yeah. that's everyone's struggle.
I know. I always want to say to people, like, game is not complicated. Yeah. It's very simple. It's not that your mind can't understand it. It's that, like, you can't marry, you know, your thoughts to an organic move that's within the world.
Like trying to be natural and do it.
Yeah, trying to do something that fits. Yeah.
That truly is the, and you know, is what kind of lawyer were you? Is that
I wasn't a lawyer. I was just a paralegal.
You were just a paralegal. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I guess
I did was the only step I made toward law school was take the LSATs.
LSATs, right, right.
Yeah.
I just think so much about like comparisons to improv in the real world, and law is a very interesting one I haven't thought mm-hmm. too much about.
Yeah.
Did you have like a catch-all you would tell people you were going to study? Like a specific
so, like,
branch
type
of law?
Law? Yeah. No, I didn't. I didn't. I hadn't even thought that far. All I thought was I need to get a good LSAT score and get a good recommendation from here so that I can get into like the top law school mm-hmm. and then have every choice in the world. It was more about that.
I see.
So yeah. let's jump ahead a little bit because I have a great question here from, I believe, our friend Cameron Azarm. And it is a spooky ghost question.
Oh, okay.
So when
yeah.
you auditioned as a team.
Mm-hmm.
And was this your first audition to get on a team?
No, I auditioned once, like right after my first 401, and that must have been 2010.
Yeah, that was before our class.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes, it was that audition, I believe, the one where Laura Wilcox
got on.
We
right.
were in class
We
together.
All auditioned in that yeah. one.
So then...
George Karaman, also in that class.
Yeah, great
on
class.
On your team. That was a stacked class. Marshall,
great
George
class.
Karaman, Katie Simon... Myself, Georgie
Aldaco,
who destroyed that class.
She destroyed. I remember so Georgie funny. And I had to do a two-man Harold together for that class because remember Shannon, it was
yeah,
the organics
yeah, yeah.
class.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Shannon's organics class, and she just made us like do that at the end, and it was so fun. And so,
Georgie's
so funny.
It was unbelievable.
All those people you just named are really funny.
Yeah. There's so many more people I didn't name, but they're all funny too.
Yeah.
Wait, just for context, because I think this is important. When did you get on Maud Night?
I was put on Maud Night like July of 2011.
And did you have shows running after Maud or pre-Maud?
So I had, the way that I got on Maud was that I had a spank for my first solo show. Mm-hmm. And Anthony King saw the spank. And on the basis of the spank, he put me on Maud.
Right.
And then that spank was...
given a run.
Yeah, given a run.
Because I do wonder if that recontextualizes the audition process for you. If
yes.
you're already a performer at UCB, does it feel... different.
Oh, well, she was.
For
this
Hopkins.
Is 2011. So
no,
I think,
I'm talking about oh,
right.
when Spooky, by the time
Ghost,
Spooky
yes.
Ghost happens.
Right, right.
So, yeah, so by the time Spooky Ghost auditioned as a team, which was 2012 then, like, I hadn't auditioned in 2011. I think I maybe signed up for a very late slot, but I remember, like, I had a new job, like, bartending somewhere, and yeah. I couldn't get out of my shift. But I also, like, didn't, I was not going to, like, rearrange my life to do the audition because I was already a performer and mm-hmm. I already had the show running. I kind of had like diversified my portfolio to an extent that I was like, I wasn't like, this is the be all end all.
Right, right,
right,
right.
Yeah.
Which helped. And then Spooky Ghost, like we didn't just randomly audition together. Like John Trowbridge contacted me and he was like, hey, me and Ben and Molly, they were kind of the architects of that mm-hmm. team. We really want to start an indie team and we want you on it and we want to like just practice Harold's, just like drill pattern game and Harold's really, really hard till the next auditions and then see if we can audition like as a team. And I was like, whoa, that's a wild idea. And I was like, I love them. So I was like, yeah, any indie team. And I think Makeouts was dead and I hadn't been doing very much improv for the last like few months. So I was like, yeah, any team that you guys are on is great.
And what was the original lineup of Spooky Ghost?
Original lineup is John Trowbridge, Molly Gaby, Ben Warhite, Alex French, Matt Denny, Josh Sharp, Hunter Nelson, and me.
Mm. That's a stacked lineup of people.
Yeah, it was
stacked.
Dope.
We have to. We're contractually obligated to say
we have to say stacked.
I remember
get hashtag stacked.
When I first told Will Hines that, I saw him in Triple Crown once, and I told him, he's like, what's your new team? And I told him the lineup, he's like, man, stacked.
Well, it was, you know. Will Hines would say stack, hashtag stack.
So how long did you guys practice together? We also haven't gotten to Cameron's question yet, have we?
Oh, well, the question was, and maybe this applies, did you guys feel pressure auditioning as a team? And like more pressure because you were auditioning it as a team? And then I think also the question, the second part of the question is, maybe after even getting on a team, was there more or less pressure on you guys because you were like self-formed?
This was also, for context for listeners, this was the first Lloyd auditions. Right. So right. Nobody knew how this auditioning as a team thing was going to work.
Yeah, this was the first Lloyd audition?
Yes.
Oh.
It was the creation of Lloyd.
Wow, yeah. I didn't realize that.
Yeah. I think, that's a good question. In terms of the pressure, I think because it was the first one that had ever happened, I don't think there was that much pressure because it was just like, well, everyone's auditioning. Yeah. Auditioning sucks for everyone. Right. We're doing it as a team. There was one other, like, what was their name? The one with Caitlin Bitsagai, that team.
Oh,
they auditioned as a team.
Oh, not Code Red.
No, it was a smaller team than Code Red.
It was,
but it was like, I think maybe formed out of that.
I want to say it was called Flagstaff or something, but it wasn't that.
Why can't we do this?
I don't remember. I have no idea. But yeah, there were two teams that auditioned as a team. It was you guys and a sort of amalgamation of Code Red.
Yeah, but I don't think they had been like, we had committed pretty hard to it. Like, I'm sorry. We had been like, just like for 6 months
practicing and knowing for this purpose. This is what you were going to do.
And John had a conversation with Nate like halfway through that 6 month period where he was like, hey, Nate, we have this idea where we'd like to audition as a team. And Nate was like, that's very interesting that you say that because we're going to do like a new thing. And we're going to, allow that. And
Like, cool. So that was a coincidence. I thought you were about to reveal that John Trowbridge was single-handedly responsible for that.
Oh, my God. That would be
system.
Amazing. No, I don't think so. Nope.
So not very much pressure, but just, like...
Not particularly pressure. I mean,
especially because in your head, there's not much pressure even going in, because you're like, if I don't get on, I don't get on.
Yeah. Although, I do remember that day that I was, very nervous. And... I will say on the record that everyone else on Spooky Ghost really brought it in that audition, and I did not. And I'm really lucky. So in that way, there was less pressure because I was treated like a callback, and the team was as a whole good.
Good.
And
oh my God, that's right. That was when you would move right to callbacks if you were on a team that was deemed of a certain level.
Right.
Yep. Wow.
Interesting. Yep. And then you guys get put on... to Lloyd Knight.
Yes.
And what was that experience like? Sort of the, I guess I haven't really, we haven't talked about the sort of very beginnings of Lloyd Knight.
Yeah.
It was kind of rocky. There was not enough time to do Heralds, right?
Yeah. Like we had to do them really quick. We had to do them, I guess we had to do them like 23 minutes or something. Yeah. And it's hard for me to remember. I mean, I remember like the Beast was weird and Will Hines like gave us notes one time and he was like, you guys got to really like take the laughter from that audience. Nicole can probably speak to this. He was like, you got to demand that shit.
You have to beg for it? Yeah. Is that what he's saying? Bring it out of them?
That might just be your interpretation.
He just told us to like play everything with like 20% more confidence than we usually would and like just like step out there. And he was like, assume that you're getting like 30% more laughs than you are hearing because you can't hear it all.
I think it's so true. Especially at that time, there was no sound reinforcement system at all at the Beast.
Well, that was a team that could pull that off as far as like going out there and being super confident.
That actually almost seems like a dangerous note to give that many funny people.
Because they were already so confident, but yeah. Did you guys feel like what was your general impression of Lloyd Knight? Was it something where you're like, this is fun? Or were you like, I don't know how I feel about this? Were you immediately just like on board and into it?
Yeah, I mean, I was on board and into it. I think, again, like, it just felt, somewhat, I don't want to say peripheral to me, because it wasn't that low status. It just felt like I thought, this is great. I want to work hard and have fun with this team and have good shows. But, like, I know staying on this team or staying on this Lloyd Knight or being promoted to Harold Knight is not going to be the thing that makes my career.
Right. And it's one of those things, too, where one of those universal things we learn from doing the podcast is like, if you make sure you don't make this thing your whole world, you tend to play more like yourself and live outside the pressure a little bit.
Yes.
And you probably, I mean, you've always been a very cool customer.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Very, very cool. I mean, that's one of the things I remember seeing about you in this class. Was that everyone was just frenetically trying to get laughs from Shannon, and you basically were just like, I'm just going to do my thing.
That and sounds like I just didn't get as many laughs.
No, no. To correct,
and it's also not
got maybe more.
Can I throw a word at you?
Yes.
I think what we're going for is effortless.
Yes.
I think like you do just feel like you're doing it and you're killing it and you're on stage, but it feels relaxing to everyone.
Yeah. Well, that's nice of you, and thank you for saying that, both of you. But I will say, like, at my best, I feel that way. Which I think describes everyone at their improv best is
right.
You feel just
for
like
sure.
It's coming out of me and I feel like I'm myself, or I feel like I'm a character, but a character that is myself or something.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of that was probably just like a veneer.
Maybe.
Because I'm a very anxious performer.
But there's, you know, but there is, I think that's such a huge part of it is just that veneer. For whatever reason,
yes.
Being
yeah.
able to fake that is something that's super, super interesting. Even
yes.
if on the inside you're, you know, anxiety ridden, but
for sure,
you always come off as a cool customer. Were you the first person pulled up from Spooky?
No, no. Not even.
Oh,
by
from Spooky?
Not even by a mile.
Oh, the, right, because it was Denny
Sharp.
I can't remember the order, but I know it was Denny Sharp and Hunter,
right?
And then maybe Alex. I think it was the four of them were all pulled over a course of a few months. Like
right.
I think it was maybe like Denny and Sharp together, and then Hunter, and then Alex, something like that. So that. We started in 2012, and then by the end of 2012, we were kind of like, we had had so many replacements, great replacements. Mm-hmm. I mean, talking like Ali Kokesh, and then Aaron Bartley, I think, and then mm-hmm. Matt Brian Cohen.
Yep.
And then at the end, the
Morgan
last person
Miller.
Was Morgan Miller, who brought
oh, wow.
so much young energy into the
yeah.
room.
And then the team changed names.
And then Nate was like, you got to change.
Were you on Bloody Mary?
For a month, yeah.
You were, interesting.
Because yeah. Bloody Mary happened, that must have been like March, and then the new shakeups happened like a month later.
May I ask a loaded question?
Yeah.
So you're Ooh. On a Lloyd team, you put yourselves together, you're like killer performers, you like performing together, but then one by one, you're getting...
picked off.
Yeah, picked off. Does that start to fuck with the left behind at all? Like, not just the readjustment to a team whose lineup is changing, but also just, like, at that point, you definitely feel like a farm team, I'm assuming.
Yes. I think I actually, when Nate made us change the name, and we were all in a rehearsal space trying to think of names, I was sort of sarcastically, why don't we just call ourselves Farm Team? But I was serious about that because I, like, wanted to make a statement about it because
right.
I was just, like, annoyed.
Yeah.
Not because I was like, oh, it would have been heard, like, but I was just like, why are you, stop, man. Leave it alone.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I, you know, those people really deserve to be on Herald Night. So, yeah. You know.
That could be, like, that was sometimes, like, not a fallback, but that was, like, a problem. Not a problem, even. It was just, like, a drawback. That's the word. Mm-hmm. Of the Lloyd Knight system.
Is that, yeah, you're pretty vulnerable at all times to change.
Yeah, yeah, but you got to know that. I think you got to know that going in.
I think,
just didn't because it was new.
Yeah,
and we had this like cockamamie idea. We're like, look, we're an indie team that got ourselves onto a Lloyd team.
We'll
There's no reason
team?
Why we can't become a Herald
we'll
team.
Yeah.
We'll be the next
team.
Law firm. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
So that became increasingly clear that was not going
to
happen.
Right, and you got then pulled up to.
To Herald Night.
Which team
yeah.
was it?
So that was a new team. It was called Namaste.
Right. Namaste was the first
Herald team. And that was me, Josh Sharp, Matt Brian Cohen, Natasha Vainblatt, Ryan Haney, Brian Glidewell, Brennan Mulligan, and...
Hate Riley?
No.
It was never on Namaste.
No, absolutely not. And
John Timothy?
John Timothy.
John Timothy,
yep.
Yeah.
Great memory. I'm terrible at this. I'm starting to lose it with the naming of
yeah.
people.
I mean, that's a hot team.
That
not
was
even
a great
stacked. That's
first
like
Herald
a talented
team.
But also attractive team.
But that
yeah.
was a. I mean, that was one of those teams that like very often new teams with you know you see them and they kind of struggle. But I just feel like Namaste was one of those teams that was just good.
Yeah, it was good. Thanks for saying that. But
yeah,
I agree. It was good. Like,
you had some super strong performers that
mm-hmm.
kind of all vibed in the same. It was one of those things where like this looks like it should make sense.
Yeah,
and
it did.
Does.
I think Josh Sharp called it four nerds, four idiots.
Oh,
he was like, it's a perfect combo.
Yeah,
four nerds for four idiots.
Very much so true.
Yeah, and I was like, I'm very happy to be one of the idiots, like with the nerds.
To have John Timothy and Matt Cohen on the same.
Yeah. Between
and
John
Brennan.
Timothy,
Brennan,
and Matt.
Holy
I mean,
shit.
We were just taken care of by those.
Holy
it's amazing
shit.
That
we were
you guys,
totally taken care of.
Yeah, it's amazing that you guys did improv shows and not campaigns. And I don't mean political campaigns. I mean, and anybody listening to it knows exactly what I mean. I mean, like, role-playing campaigns.
Got it.
What is a role-playing campaign?
It's like Dungeons and Dragons or something.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That is not my wheelhouse.
Listen, I'm with you, Joanna. I don't know what you're talking about.
Who is your fourth nerd?
Brian Glidewell.
Oh, duh.
Yeah.
Duh.
But then he got replaced by, when he moved to LA, and he got replaced by Chet Siegel, who is another idiot. So then we were five idiots and three nerds.
But you still were fine.
Yeah, we were great. It was fun. You know, I think we made that team good because I think people don't say this enough. Like, everyone just had a lot of reps and was not green.
Yeah, totally.
Like, nobody was green.
It was nobody's first team.
It was nobody's first team.
Nobody's green, but also nobody's brown. By which I mean has gone bad.
Yeah. That's right.
It's a banana.
You know what it is? Okay. I think it was one of the first teams that benefited from the Lloyd system.
Like, there was a lot of former Lloyd.
Former Lloyd people who got the reps.
Josh, Matt, Natasha had all been on Lloyd.
Yeah. And it's like the people who got the reps on Lloyd and understood what that was like, and then their first Herald team was able to be good because they didn't have the like freak out of being on your first team.
Yeah. And I always hear on this podcast, especially, but also in person, people talk about the drama of like sending crazy emails to each other and like whatever. There was just none of that. Like, I don't remember deciding on the name, but we all picked it in like 30 seconds. And I don't, like, we would switch up our song, like our entrance song, whenever we wanted. Someone would just email and be like, can we come out to this tonight? And we'd be like, yeah.
It was never a big deal.
It was not an issue.
Did you have any, so at this point, I mean, you're deep into the improv game. You're loving it. Did you have any like standout shows or any moments where like that really clicked with you where you're like, wow, I've just, I remember Namaste had some really cool shows.
Yeah, we tried out a lot of different openings,
right?
Which was really fun. We had some really good coaches. Achilles was really great. Frank Hale was really great. We had Don Finelli for a hot second in the beginning. He was great. I think we had a cage match run that was really fun.
Yeah, I do remember that. Yeah.
Where we really thrived.
And it was kind of the breaking of the seal of Herald teams winning cage match. I know Captcha won a few before, but didn't really have a run.
Captcha won doing musical improv.
But they didn't really have a run like Namaste
musical
did.
I think we had a long, we were like, it was like 10 weeks or something, really long. Yeah. Like, it was long to the point where I started to, like, look around on Thursday nights and be like, are we gonna win this? Because, like, I'm tired.
Yeah, that's so funny.
Which sounds very cocky, but what are you gonna do? Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. And I remember a really good moment in a cage match show. I have no idea how this happened, but we were doing something about Spider-Man. And before I even knew what happened, Brennan was behind the stage doing that thing where you climb up the wall and come over the top, something
classic
that I've never
match.
Done. Classic cage match move, man. Classic Brennan move to drop down from the ceiling. So he was climbing up that wall and somehow like Matt, I think it was Matt or John Timothy, like saw that he was doing that, tagged out the like talking about Spider-Man scene, then like became a robber, a mugger, and started to mug Ryan Haney, I think. And Ryan Haney immediately was like, no, my purse. He like knew what was going on. And then Brennan dropped from the ceiling, punched Matt or John Timothy, whoever it was, in the face and kissed Ryan Haney. And I was like, I was just watching this. It happened in 10 seconds. And I was watching it like, how did anybody think about that? But it was so fucking cool. And I was like, oh, that's improv.
So it's like one of those moments that you're like observing and you're in the show.
You're in the show and you're just like, I don't know how any, you guys all, and it was such a perfect example of like working together. All it was like observing, like, oh, Brennan's going back there. I know what he's going to do. Oh, I know what you're doing. Oh, I'm supposed to be a lady. Oh, cool. Kiss me. Now we get a fucking applause break.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
You really need the nerds for that one, but definitely.
You really do.
That is, that sounds really cool.
It was awesome.
And also, it sounds effortless again, just really seamless. I think the most intense thing Namaste ever did as a team was when you went after Smithfield.
Like, oh, God.
Is that where all of your intensity as
you
a team
know,
went?
You know that I'm the wrong person to ask about this, right?
No, why?
You don't know the story behind that?
No.
Oh, gosh. Because I really always enjoyed Smithfield.
I still do.
After its location
Smithfield.
Change. I mean, the food is, you can get a nice salad there. You can't get that at McManus.
Yeah.
You're going to die from whatever they serve as salad at McManus.
I think the whole, let's bring the listeners up to speed.
Let me tell you what happened. Yeah. Brian Glidewell decided, he was, I think, feeling very like New York patriotic, moving to LA. He decided, like, after Herald Night, we shouldn't go to Smithfield. We should go to McManus. We should keep it old school. Also, because I guess he was an old school guy, had been around for a while. And he was like, he wrote some email that was like, what if I got us all shirts? It said like, Smithfield never, McManus forever.
So freeze for 1 second. For our listeners who have no idea what we're talking about, McManus is this bar on 19th Street that is historically a UCB bar. People used to go there after shows, after cage match, all the time.
When I think it was conveniently located to where the UCB was.
Right.
Kind of not.
But
as
then
much.
Now it moved to 20. We moved to the new location, but we still go there just because we know the people that work there.
Yeah, and you
still
can get a nice cheap beer.
It's a fun bar to go to.
It's fun. It's fun.
But
it's a dive bar.
But it's a dive bar. Yeah. Smithfield, this sort of restaurant bar, like it's a, beer
it's
garden
a
sort
sterile
of
sterile sports bar.
Yeah.
But it is, you can always get a table somehow. It's never that crowded.
Right.
They have like food that you can get like a delicious turkey burger or tacos.
Right.
You can get like, you know.
Caesar salad you have to put together yourself.
You don't like
look,
that?
There's lots of great things. But also it's like a thing where like they were also very nice to UCB people. They gave us discounts. They were like very amenable to us there.
Yes.
So I think people, even before Smithfield, people stopped going to McManus as much. And then Smithfield sort of took over as this new popular place to go.
Yes.
So then Brian, an old school
guy,
McManus
was like,
guy.
Let me make these shirts. They're going to be green. They're going to look like Shamrock style. And it's going to say McManus forever, Smithfield. McManus forever on the front, Smithfield never on the back. And he was like, we should wear these every time we do cage match. And oh boy, buddy, it was like, you know, just a group game had started. That I knew I had to step out for to be a supportive teammate, but I did not want to be
like, I don't want to do it.
At no point
but
did
I
want to
yes
do this.
This.
I was like, I hate this whole thing because I, first of all, what did Smithfield ever do to us? And second of all, this I hate this shirt. I hated the way it looked. It was like half polyester.
That's so funny.
But that's also, I think it's such a great reminder of like, just fucking go with
just
it.
Just go with it. Just do it and wear the shirt. It won't kill you, but you know.
That's so funny.
It's really funny. I also guarantee that conversation about the relative benefits of Smithfield and McManus to some listeners is more infuriating than anything they've ever listened to on the podcast.
Well, that's okay. I think
I'm just sure.
Fine.
I guess I'm thinking specifically of Matt Cutler, right? Who's listening right now?
Does he love which he loves McManus? Okay.
McManus is fine if you
it's
want
fine.
To go,
I go there all
like
time.
Hang out and drink and stuff. But if you're like trying to get something to eat,
if you'd like to have a civilized meal with somebody, if you'd like to have an exchange with adults, you go to Smithfield.
Thank
if you want to have a raucous 4 a.m. night, you go to McManus.
I have a question for you, and it might maybe isn't related to what we were talking about, but you are an incredible performer of characters.
Thanks, Sean.
Right? So how did you get good at that? Like so here's my sort of thing is like, I just always assumed that you had some sort of actor background. How is that not possible? How did you figure this out? Is it a thing where like, And I was going to say this earlier, but like growing up in New York kind of gives you a little bit of a leg up. One, it's like easy to find your way to UCB. Like, I think that's a funny thing for people that live in New York.
You mean like walking?
Find your way. But I mean, just like, you know, my sister went to UCB. Like, I had to like find it on the internet somehow.
Sure.
But like, the other thing is like, do you find that you've always been an observer of characters in that way? Or is that something you've trained yourself to do?
Yeah, no, I always did it. When I was a kid, I would always do impressions of whoever, my parents, my teachers, whatever. I learned many, many years later that when I was a little kid, like all my relatives thought that I would be an actor because I would do voices and stuff. But again, it was not something that...
This is probably, again, why your sister was like, you should probably do this.
Yeah, it was probably something that everyone picked up on, but it was not something that specifically my parents were like...
Encouraging.
Right. So... yeah, I think I always did it, and I always liked it, but didn't really have an outlet for it besides like the way you do with your friends.
Yeah, and I guess I realize that now because even in this conversation, I feel like you've done three separate characters,
really?
Where I'm like, these are good characters. Okay. You've done a few where I'm like, I always wanted
when
to ask
that question.
When we first
came in, it was like girl who didn't know where the third chair was,
right?
And
right,
thought
right.
She was gonna have to stand
exactly.
For a while.
There was the puke vomit guy.
There was puke vomit guy. I kind of started that.
You
kind of
did.
You
kind of
nailed. You really defined it for me. But no, there, it's just funny. I think it is something that you naturally do. So it's fun to see that you like found the natural way to like express these things on stage. So like doing a one person show probably felt like this is everything. And probably why improv maybe took like the back seat to that.
Yeah. I think like I loved doing improv and I still love doing it. I really wanted to have stuff that I was writing. That was my whole goal from the beginning. And then I think I don't want to say I lost my way a little bit. I think I got as into improv as everybody else does and is like obsessed with Harold Knight. I would go every single week, all that shit, every weekend, go see weekend teams. And I was, it's not like losing your way, but it's more like I took like a little detour.
Yeah,
that was my
journey,
detour. This part of the journey. And it made me better. It made me such a better writer. But mm-hmm. I really was like, I want to make things that are original that I can hone. And they kind of came that some people that comes out as sketches. And for me, it came out as characters. And I started doing it early is the thing. Like I took a character class back in 2010.
With like Mike Still?
No, with Becky Drysdale. Becky was when Becky Drysdale was like doing her New York classes for like a hot sec when she was in the city. So she was doing improv classes. I had taken one improv class with her and we had like really gelled. And then George Karaman was mm-hmm. going to take her solo show class. And he was like, Joe, you should take it. Just like, don't be an idiot.
I remember that.
Yeah. And I was very resistant to it.
And both of those shows came out of that class,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, I would say mine more than his because I think he just like added a whole lot more stuff later. But mine, like, really, I didn't realize how much like backloaded I was with like character stuff that I wanted to get out. So every week we'd come to class and you'd have to bring a new character. And I was just like, boom, boom, boom.
I
had so
six.
Much. I just had so much stuff that I was like, whoa, I have been wanting to put this down on paper for many, many years. I've been backed up.
Wow.
I was real character constipated.
To jump back to the improv side for a second. Talk about moving up to Death by Ruru.
Yeah.
What was that like? So it was Namaste, then Death by Ruru, or was there a team between?
No, it was just Namaste.
Namaste, right.
So like Namaste, that's 2013. And then, so that's like April 2013. And then Ruru is May 2014. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't, like, they just ask you to come, like, sit in. And then you sit in a bunch of times.
How often were you sitting in?
I had probably, by the time they officially asked me to join, I'd probably sat in five times.
So not like, not an insane amount.
Not an insane amount, but like a bunch. Mm-hmm.
For me, I remember sitting in on a weekend show was like, oh, this is what that anxiety feels like that I forgot about from years and years of working it out of my system.
Well, I had never worked it out of my system. I'll tell you, I was still on Harold Knight, still like... pretty anxious, although I had relaxed a lot more in the last like 6 months of it.
Right.
But you were not eating pizza on your way into Harold Knight yet.
Yeah, not exactly. I could maybe eat like a granola bar.
Worse.
Yeah, I could eat something small, but yeah. I think also just like the vibe of Harold Knight when you're in that green room is so much more anxiety ridden. People are like, okay,
yeah,
we gotta go warm up. We gotta gotta get notes, and let's make sure we do this and this and this tonight. You know, like not to delegitimize it, but it's just. Really cultivates just an environment of just tremendous anxiety.
Interesting. I wonder. Compared to the weekend.
Right.
But I'm also just thinking about how many Harold Knights I wandered in and it was just like good girl on the couches drinking rosé.
Good girl might be. I mean, if your team's been together for a couple of years, maybe there's an exception.
If you're hanging out in the actual green room, you're fine. But if you're in the back hallway doing something for like 30 minutes, you're freaking out.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, that's my
experience.
I agree.
My memory at all.
No one on Namaste ever really got to the point. I think like Josh Sharp and I were the only ones. This is maybe when I started to relax and then subsequently got the note from Nate Dern that I was relaxing too much. No one besides Josh Sharp and I ever... we're kind of just like cool with like just hanging in the green room and being like, I don't know, whatever. Everyone was pretty set on like, let's go, let's warm up, let's do this properly, which which is great. And we were just both kind of like, I don't know, let's like sing a Beyonce song. I don't know. Which is
that's
what we
enough
did
for me.
Yeah.
So did you feel like when you're sitting in with Death by Ruru, was this like, oh, this is a good fit? They do a mono scene.
Yeah.
They kind of play in a sort of,
they back then, well, so right, so Death by Ruru did Fucked Up Family form, which was that in the beginning you take an audience member onto the stage and you interview them about their fucked up family, and then you do a montage off that, and then second half you do a mono scene. I had sat in with Law Firm a couple times before that, and I had fun, but yeah, it felt a little bit less.
Well, Law Firm does the opposite, where it's like, let's do a LaRonde. So
yeah,
like,
I don't even remember what they were doing then.
I think they've been doing it.
It was just like, I just remember like a montage with Law Firm, but yeah. I don't know. That was like 2013 when I sat in with them. And then, yeah, so sitting in with Ruru was really fun. Like, the first show that I did, the only people there were John Murray and Anthony Tamanic. So, like, these two incredibly great vet improvisers and me. And when you know, when you have a three-person show for an hour, like, you're playing the entire time. Mm-hmm. So there was no room for me to do any kind of back wall. Like, I just couldn't do it. And it was a great show. Like, we had a fantastic show. I think that really made me feel like, oh, I can do this. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely capable of doing this. I just need to, like, every show be in that mindset where I'm like, there's just no room for you to have no courage. There's no room for you to, like, be protecting your ego on the back line.
That's also an interesting point because Death by Ruru at the time had no female members, right?
Yeah, no.
So was going into it, did that factor into your thought process at all? Was it like, well, these bunch of dudes asked me to do this show. Like, I guess I'm just wondering, like, what was that like? Was that something you thought about or was it not even a thought?
I thought for a moment, I was like, maybe they're trying to add a girl. But then I thought about that team and I was like, they don't give a fuck about that shit.
That's very true. I mean, that's like probably the right thought. I mean, I don't know what their thought process was, but I don't think they... To me, I don't think a Tamanic is a person that's going to be like, well, we have to do this for whatever reason. It's just
right.
They
can you
just
imagine
Anthony
a Tamanic being like, well, we should do something because other people want us to. It doesn't function that way.
I mean, in a way, and that's got to be validating for you. That's got to be like, well, they must really think I'm good.
I don't think I don't know how much any of them knew about me. I know Dan Black, before he left, was trying to get me to come sit in. And so he was kind of like knew me and he was into it. Then about like being a woman on a team, I didn't really cross my mind because I at that point at least knew myself well enough as an improviser where I was like, I know that I can play. I play men all the time anyway. I mean, like, I'm really dykey and it's okay like for me to chill with these dudes. Like, I'm not worried about that. So, that kind of melted away pretty fast. I more felt these guys are so vet and I'm so much greener and younger in that way. That was more what was on my mind.
Yeah.
But did you think, like, I'm being considered to move to Ruru?
I thought it was a possibility, but having sat in with Law Firm the year before and that not having happened, I was like, it could happen, could not, but I didn't count my chickens at all.
But after you're sitting in with them like four or five times, are you starting to think I'm probably going to move to this team?
I didn't think I'm probably going to move to this team, but I thought, what are they doing? Right. And then this was a weird experience where like a weird rumor started to circulate that I had been added to Ruru and I had not been. And so I had people coming up to me in the training center being like, hey, congratulations. And I was like, motherfucker, nothing has happened. Like, you don't know what you're talking about.
I mean, I do remember it was said. Because I think this was like around when auditions were coming up and everyone was like, well, how many slots we got to fill?
Well,
there's the Joanna moving to Death by Ruru slot.
Yeah.
Like it was just known and I guess, but it hadn't officially happened.
It hadn't,
really curious about how that affects your interactions with your Herald team. Right?
It didn't
you
know
seem
what?
Like the type of Herald team that it would affect.
Yeah, everyone was very secure on that team. And I think a couple weeks before they asked me to move to Ruru, Natasha moved to What I Did for Love.
And then J-Tim
moved to Curfew the same week that I moved to Death by Ruru.
Right, and those three were the three that then were replaced. And then who replaced
Anthony Pruzzi.
Anthony Pruzzi joined when I was... He must have replaced Natasha because he joined. We were on the same team for like a few weeks.
Gotcha.
Got it.
Oh, and then you guys didn't get replaced. What team did that become?
There was five. There's
five. Must become Women and Men or sort of Women and Men?
Yeah.
A lot of it became Women and Men.
Whom, fun trivia fact, whom I once introduced when I was hosting Herald Night as Men and Women.
Wait, I think I might have been there.
Yeah, I feel like I was there too.
It was disastrous.
I think I heard about it because didn't they use it or something?
Maybe.
I don't know. I might have been there and then you came back into the tech booth and I was like, it's Women and Men.
That's so funny. That's interesting. Okay, so I don't know if this is the kind of stuff that we're supposed to talk about, but Namaste was the team that people were talking about moving to the weekend next. I think Bucky had just moved.
Yeah.
And then there was like, you guys were maybe taking over, like if there was an open weekend slot, you guys were doing
shows. Oh, they were doing weekend shows, right?
You were doing weekend shows. And there was a lot of talk. And then like very quickly, that team was kind of decimated.
It was the same. Yeah, it was almost like a repeat of the Spooky situation where it was like, we were hitting our stride. and everybody was doing pretty good. And we started to say, hey, you guys think we might move up a notch? And then everyone was gone.
Yeah.
That's the thing is never mention moving up.
Don't
as
fucking
a
look each other in
then...
the eye and say, do you think maybe? Yeah. A weird thing happened where like Nate Dern sent Josh an email where he was like, hey, I'm considering like making a slot after ASCAT on Sundays. Hmm. And he said something like, if you guys won this cage match run, it would be like maybe easier for me to like
sell that. Right.
Which is like, and then Josh relayed that to us, which of course, then everyone was like boners popped through their pants like, oh, we got to win a cage match. And then we didn't win cage match.
Oh, no.
I think we lost to Ruru.
I think.
That's gotta hurt.
No.
Yeah, we did. I remember because my girlfriend came.
Right. You lost to Ruru, but not in the finals.
No, it was like the semifinals.
Right. Because then I think maybe it was like, It was Death by Ruru versus Scrambled Legs.
Yeah.
I think so because I remember being really excited by the possibility of it being Scrambled Legs and Namaste. Because I was like, an indie team against a Herald team would be like,
oh, right.
Cool.
And then it was Ruru, and then Ruru still won. I remember that.
Yeah, and then nothing means anything.
Moving to Death by Ruru, that must have, I mean, obviously that's been great. Now you've transitioned into GOAT.
Yeah, that happened at the end of last year.
Right. And have you found that, like, your improv has changed at all on the weekend?
Yeah, of course. I think both you guys can speak to that too. Right. Like, it just, you are required to do certain things and not required any longer to do other things. Like, you don't have to call anything back. You're not obligated to call anything back.
You don't
just
have to
call
a second beat of anything.
Yeah, whatever is the best thing, you call back. Or, like, you're never worrying about blowing something out too much to save for calling back. Like, if you're having fun with something, you just blow, and then like, and then at the end, you could like just reference it.
Hold on, I have a question here, and you have to answer it.
Okay.
Could you talk a little bit about the Death by Ruru set, where at the end you essentially played every character from the show?
Oh God!
That question. Do you remember that? Was that like
a
highlight? Because that sounds.
I remember it. It was. I do remember it. I'm going to start backwards by saying that. That night felt nice to me. It was really fun. It was a great show. Everybody was great. But I'm going to start backwards by saying that John Gamberling's dad always comes to every single show. And he stands in the back. And he still comes to GOAT shows. And at the end of that show, I think I had maybe been on the team for like a couple months. Like maybe 6 weeks or something officially by then. I don't know. But he came up to me afterward. And he's a very like sensitive dude and a very like, he makes a lot of eye contact.
Love
he's
Mr.
Very sweet. Very sweet. And he was like, you are always wonderful. Tonight, you were fantastic.
Oh my God, that's so great.
He like grabbed me by the elbow and said that. I was so sweet.
Wow.
He was very, very sweet. But basically what happened was the whole thing, it was a mono scene that took place in a sheriff's office that was being sort of overrun with FBI agents, the way that like in TV shows, the FBI agent will show up and flash their badge and the cop will get mad and here come the spooks. Like, so I was like the sheriff of the office, and there was some supernatural something that was happening where people were able to jump bodies from I could jump into your body and then you could jump into mine. So people
Nicole
were like,
is shaking her head.
It's just like, it could not be more rude.
Yeah, I think it was like everybody was there too. It was like full attendance that night. And so everybody was like jumping into each other's bodies, which was cool because people were jumping like, you know, it was like a cop or an FBI agent was jumping into the body of a criminal who was like in the interrogation room and vice versa. So that was cool. Like statuses were changing. Mm-hmm. Okay, Nicole, it was legitimate. Statuses were changing. Yes,
that is an improv word.
And so that was happening. But I think toward like as we were going along, everyone kind of realized that like I hadn't jumped and nobody had jumped into me either. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of this like just straight ahead like genre character where like I was just like the sheriff, like a small town sheriff. And then I started and everyone was like, you don't even seem to. It was that thing. It was that meta move where my teammates are noticing that, like, I don't have anything that specific going on about me. But then like their characters are saying, like, you seem like you're just like a regular guy, like almost too standard, stereotypical. And so then I just started pushing into like stereotypes about these type of guys. And I was like, but I enjoy missionary sex with my wife or whatever, like things like that. And then something happened where the jumping, they decided that they were just going to, like, really fuck me up. So everyone jumped into my body and left the stage. But it, like, happened, like, it all happened in this, like, huge, like, hurricane of, like, just activity. Mm-hmm. So everyone, like, jumped into my body and I started, like, morphing into, like, all the different characters that they'd been. And then they left the stage. And then I, like, I don't know, I just, like, flipped and flopped and, like, went crazy on the ground, like, just trying my best to do all the recognizable things from those characters. And then I think Anthony walked right on and, like, gave some blackout line, and that was it.
Wow. That sounds like, I mean, that sounds like an A-tip, that sounds like a Death by Ruru show. Like, what you just described, if I were to write, like, a fake Death by Ruru show, that would be it. There's, yeah, like, a, there's hard, yeah, tropes from,
if
some
you were
sort
doing, like,
genre,
an Inside Baseball, like, making fun of Death by Ruru thing, you're like, oh, yeah, and then what happens? Like, a bunch of guys all jump into one person and they play all the characters. Like, oh, okay, all right, yeah, real Death, like, by Ruru.
Super hard genre, and then a Tamanic throws in some sort of supernatural thing that, right, then throws everything for a loop. And then somehow it ties together in a cacophony of madness.
Right.
That's always a death.
Cacophony
of
madness would be the objective.
And was that just a regular Saturday night show?
Yeah.
That's, to me, and nobody in the audience, nobody listening is going to think that, to me, that's the coolest part. Yeah. Because
doing something very, like, lofty and,
yeah,
on a weekend.
On a weekend.
Yeah.
Like, if you told me that was, like, a cage match show, I'd be like, badass. That's really cool.
Right.
But I just think sometimes you have... weekend teams have to hold themselves to a very high show standard because, mm-hmm, the audience is not an improv audience.
Right.
So they're really happy with funny.
Right.
Yes.
So
but
to take
do
a risk
cool,
on something cool.
That's, yeah, awesome. I just think that's badass.
Yeah. I think, like, I don't think anyone, and I think still on GOAT, like, nobody is approaching it. And it didn't feel to me on Ru like anyone was approaching it. Like, maybe I'm so ill-informed because I was literally the last person to be added to that team after a decade of players. But when I was on it, it didn't feel as though anyone was approaching it saying, let's hold ourselves to a standard. It just, but I know what you're saying. It, yeah, felt more just like, why wouldn't we do,
right,
well, like,
right,
let's just do it.
The,
like, why wouldn't,
blowing,
yeah, why wouldn't we do, like, whatever fucking crazy idea and make something crazy and then force everyone else to justify it and commit to it? Because, like, part of it is, like, vibe of that team was a lot of fucking with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Cause, mm-hmm, the, you know, when we go out on stage, we would, like, hit each other's backs and say, instead of got
your
back, say,
back,
watch your back.
Mm-hmm.
It's
which
funny.
Was just like, I
can,
felt truthful.
Can we talk really quickly about Improvised Seinfeld?
Yeah.
So this is a show that was developed after the mod show. But what was it called? Lazy Susan?
The Leaning Susan.
The Leaning Susan. So your mod team made a theme show, which was a half an hour Seinfeld episode.
Yeah.
Which was great. And I think is online. And honestly, watched it online. And, like, I saw it in person, then watched it online. And I remember being like, this might be one of the greatest pieces of art I've seen.
Oh my God. You should watch a real Seinfeld show.
Because,
they're very well shot.
I love
and good.
Seinfeld. But just part of the, I just, there's something about everything I know about all the elements going into it and how it was created and, like, the fact that this came, I don't know. There's just something amazing about the Seinfeld
and
show.
That it's like, you just wrote a really good episode of
that's
Seinfeld.
That's what the craziest,
yeah,
thing is. Like, if
it's
if,
not referencey, it's not postmodern.
If someone sat down and said, let's write a good episode of Seinfeld and stage it, it probably turned into some sort of, like, you know,
referencey,
yeah, like,
90s novelty.
Yeah, but
yeah,
it's,
yeah,
not,
yeah,
that. It's just an episode of Seinfeld.
Yeah, that's because the writers on that team, which was Bellevue, mm-hmm, were, before that, they were writing really excellent sketch shows.
Right.
So they were just like, let's apply the same standards that we hold ourselves to
for
every
Seinfeld
sketch show, for the Seinfeld. And everyone in the room was like, we will not make this some, like, novelty bullshit.
Yeah.
And people, the writers on that team were just very serious and very good.
It's amazing.
You know?
But that sketch show has now, I guess, transitioned into just an improv show.
Yeah.
Where it's the cast of the show.
Yeah, it's the four main guys, mm-hmm, people, Jerry, George, Elaine, and Kramer.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always themselves and they always dress in costume.
Right.
And the rest of us just play whatever other characters would show up in that show.
So is this other writers on the team doing it now, or,
mm-hmm,
like, so
everybody plays together?
So everyone plays. So that's great. How do you guys approach that show? Because I have an interest in this because I'm thinking a lot about how you can, mm-hmm, like, do an improv show that has costumes and set characters.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
How do you guys approach that? What was the approach on this?
Well, I wasn't there for the very first show, which was on Del Close. I was too hungover on that Sunday.
Everyone preaching the choir.
Such an asshole. But yeah. what we're doing now, we're still kind of working it out, but we have most of the bones worked out, is that the four main players do, well, first, sorry, Noah Forman does as Seinfeld, he does stand-up. So he gets a suggestion, and then he does stand-up, just like a monologue. Off of that, we go into, somebody edits on the back line. We have three, I think, microphones on the back wall so that anyone can edit, because the way we edit is going like, bow, 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 right, instead of sweeping. Right. So somebody edits his monologue. We go into the first scene, which is almost like a deconstruction or an event day, right, or something. A deconstruction. A source scene. More like, yeah. A source scene, yeah. So source scene.
And this is at the diner.
And this is, no, source scene is always at Jerry's apartment, where any Seinfeld episode usually starts. Mm-hmm. And it's Jerry is in his apartment, and then someone comes in, one of the characters, and just based off of his monologue, initiates a scene. And all three characters have to come into Jerry's apartment during that scene and have a thing, have a deal. They start it with Jerry. And then someone on the back wall edits, and we just do first beats of all of those three ideas the same way you would in a Harold. Mm-hmm. Then we do a group game, and for group games, like, initially we've been like, let's do commercials, but it's a really heavy burden to commit yourself to do a commercial every group game because, right, you don't always have that idea. So now we're just like, we'll go back to either Jerry's apartment or the diner, and everyone will be there. And we'll just kind of all regroup and do some kind of thing. Or if a commercial occurs to us, we can do that. Then we do second beats. And then we do another group game. And then at the end, we do third beats that are intentionally Connection Island, because that is the format of Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. Where you connect A, B, C stories together.
So you are doing a Harold, basically.
We're doing a Harold, but a Harold is a Seinfeld show.
Yeah,
so, yeah.
I mean, you're applying the theory that everyone has of like, oh, Seinfeld is a Harold.
Yeah,
you're
right. Actually, everyone cracked that code that both of those formats are using the number three organize their comedy.
Oh, that's funny.
Fucking brilliant.
Oh, that's great. And how has this show been going? How's it been being received?
People really, really like it a lot. I think people are really satisfied to see those characters, first of all,
insane.
The impressions are fantastic.
Catherine Mudon is insane Elaine. It's disgusting.
Yeah, she's fantastic. They're all like so good at it. Yeah. And everyone, and the costumes are great. Like, I'm into that because I don't, like, I know there's all these rules about, like, don't reach for your real wallet, reach for your improv wallet. And I agree with that to an extent. I don't like seeing people make a fake phone with their hands. You got to make a real one. Yeah. But like in the last show, Mike Antonucci was doing something where he had crabs, like, Matt Moskowiak had to spray him with extermination fluids sprays. And Antonucci took his real pants down, and it was funny to see his underpants on stage. Like, underpants is funny.
Yeah, no,
and
that's
also
really funny.
It sort of feels like if your character's in costume.
Yeah.
It'd be weird to see him take off his improv
pants.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm so interested in costumed improv. Like, this is like my new thing that I'm freaking out.
Isn't that like
about
what they do in Chicago? Or they don't do, they do like uniformed improv.
Well, I think they might, but then they also have shows like the Brady Bunch improv show that's like similar to that. Mm-hmm. And then I think they did the Real World at UCB, which was like show where they all came in the same character every week.
Yeah, I mean, costumed improv has definitely been done before.
Yeah,
so
I'm very interested in that. And I'm interested to see this. I haven't seen improvised Seinfeld yet, so I'm interested to see it.
Yeah, we have a few more shows, I think.
I'm just thinking about the fact that, like, you've said this a few times, and I know that, like, you're, like, spoiler alert, maybe interested in ASP down the road.
Possibly.
That deals with this.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you've reached a point, I'm so sorry, Jonah, because
this
is about Sean Diston.
Ahead.
As an improviser, where your curiosity is about directing or teaching it and not necessarily doing it as much.
I mean, I would love to do it.
Yeah.
But I know it won't happen unless I teach it. Mm-hmm. It's kind of the thought process.
Although,
I'm in.
I guess you do kind of do it with Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah. I mean, I do. I've done stuff
or
like this.
Connor's definitely doing it.
Connor is 100% doing it. And I think that's another reason why I'm like finding it so fun, is because I can't believe the amount of comedy that he's been able to mine from this costumed character.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I'm sorry.
Or Terry Withers, right? Is like sort
Terry
of
Withers is
with
the exact same thing. Yeah. This is why I'm like interested in that as well.
It seems more like Sean is like just has the power and the say so now to like
I'm
institute
just
new
Professor
things.
X, basically, and that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And that's Nicole looks disgusted. Joanna, did you ever take the? It seemed, and I probably know the answer to this. Did you ever take the time to like get into coaching improv or trying to teach people how to do improv? Is
I coached a lot.
The question I ask everyone, is there a note that you gave a lot that you felt like was the note that you were getting or giving or hearing a lot? Like, did you note against your own sort of improv bias?
I noted to the things that helped me the most. I guess that, like,
right.
A lot of my notes were organized around nuggets that, like, very wise nuggets that I had received that I would pass along, hopefully pragmatically, and every now and then in a grander, larger wisdom of improv sense.
What were some of those nugs?
Anthony King said that he stole this from somebody else. I don't know who, I forget who, but he said, I took a class with him, ASP Harold, and he said, there are two initiations at the top of every scene. There's the initiation of the comedic idea and the initiation of the base reality. And you have to keep those, both of those two threads continuing the entire time. So the note that I often give to people is I'm like, just go back and do the next thing. Do mm-hmm. what you were doing. Be a doctor, be a student, be in your kitchen, pour yourself a cup of coffee, drive the car, do the next fucking thing that you would do if this was your real life, because this is real life. Go back to your base reality.
Man, Anthony
Great
King.
Note.
That's
King.
An amazing note. But Anthony King.
He's so brilliant.
I was thinking about this the other
He's
day.
He's so brilliant.
Because there was this second beat discussion on Facebook, and Anthony King sort of added his point of view, and I just remember being like, Anthony King has so much fucking knowledge. He once told me in an organic workshop, like we did an organic openings workshop,
mm-hmm.
and I've done many workshops where I don't remember stuff that has come mm-hmm. out of it, but he said one thing that I've said thousands of times, and it's like, I always credit him. He just said the term, yes and behavior. And that wasn't
Absolutely.
Something that wasn't something mm-hmm. that was like illustrated to me as a point.
Mm.
And when you're doing an organic opening, a lot of it is just yes-anding behavior.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was like, holy shit, it's not follow the follower. Oh. It's yes-anding behavior.
Or also, I think like follow the follower, it could be described that way
Definitely.
Too.
Definitely. I mean,
follow
100%.
The follower would be a lot better if you were yes-anding behavior and not mimicking like a monkey.
Right. I mean,
yeah.
when follow the follower
is
breaks
good.
Out of the mimicking,
mm-hmm.
it
yeah.
is just... Yes, any behavior. Yeah. And I remember hearing that.
Oh, God, that's great.
And it's something that in any opening that has behavior as part of the way you generate ideas, I've always known that you just have to direct people into yes, any behavior.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But man, Anthony King.
He's so great, man. People don't talk about him. And,
they
like, I'm like acting like he's dead. He's like very successful in Hollywood, but like people in the community don't talk about Anthony King enough.
I think part of it was the mystique of just.
He was at arm's length, that
he
dude.
Was he was not a person that was very.
Talk about a cool customer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was,
God
well,
bless him.
And I think also loomed so large as artistic director for so many of us.
Yeah.
Right,
but like
right.
if you had him as a teacher, he was such a good teacher.
He was great.
Was there anyone, Joanna, that you thought was like your person? I mean, maybe it was Becky Drysdale or maybe.
I mean, I would say it was a combo. It was a moment in time for me when I had a combo all in a row that really helped me. And that was, I guess it went Becky, Klepper, Anthony.
Fuck.
And they just made me like Anthony King. Mm-hmm. They were just like the perfect combo because Becky's her whole like improv philosophy was great. It was really fresh. It was like from Chicago, but it was really like stripped down.
I would say her coming to New York and teaching those classes really shot some energy into the indie community.
Yes,
because
it did.
People
mm-hmm.
really resonated with it and it created this like I don't know, it was really
it changed the game. She
it
also
changed
like
the game.
She had a long view. She'd been around for a long time. She'd been doing improv since she was like 18 and here she was, you know, I don't know, she was like near 30 then. And one thing that she said to me, which I also always say to people, is you just have to suck for a while. And
mm-hmm.
like you don't beat yourself up, but like you're gonna suck. And you just have to get through this part. Like, don't worry about that. Like you're in 301 and like your scenes are still not good, or you're in 401 or 501 and some of your scenes are still like not good. Like, yes, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You just gotta suck for a while. And that is it's the improv equivalent of like he's just not that into you.
Mm.
It's just like, yeah, it's the truth. It's freeing.
I have a hypothetical for you.
Yeah.
For someone you see doing improv that plays themselves a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And probably teachers might give them the note like play more characters or do stuff more outside of your, you know, I guess like people that play one note a lot of the time. Is there something you can tell them to increase their range as an actor or like help them play more characters? Because that might be something that came naturally to you. So I wonder if there's sort of a pragmatic approach to that as well.
I, I don't think it's necessary to, like, I know that people are supposed to have, like, a wide range, but it's not necessary because your voice is your voice. I mean, like, I play with Chad Carter every weekend, and he's a brilliant improviser.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen him play a character, really. I mean, not really.
Very true.
He doesn't act a character. He'll be different people, and he can say anything truthfully that a different kind of person would play. So I would say this to them. I would say, if what doesn't come naturally to you is doing a voice or having a different posture or like getting down on the floor like an animal, if that shit doesn't come naturally to you, if it doesn't feel truthful and funny to you, that's fine. Don't be afraid to endow yourself or receive the endowment of, like, you're a 12-year-old girl from Russia. Then just, if you don't want to like do the accent or like walk like a little girl from Russia, fine. Say all the things that you think are truthful. Still be right. Her as much as you can in your head if that's how it comes out.
And do you also think that, like, if you say the stuff that she would say and really empathetically embody her, no one's going to notice or care about the trappings as much?
I agree. Yeah. And people will only notice, like, that, okay, Chad stayed next to Anthony, and a weekend team people will be like, or a weekend night audience mm-hmm. will be like, whoa, that Anthony guy, if they knew his name, wow, he can sure do, like, he can really act and do all these accents.
Oh,
but they're not going to notice, like, oh, that Chad right. guy didn't sufficiently play that
right.
Russian
nope,
girl.
No, they're just going to be like,
they're
oh, that.
Be like, they're both really good. That yeah. Anthony guy.
And then if
that
they,
weird guy made his body weirder.
Right.
And then exactly. if they do accents and, like, embody the character, but then say stuff that isn't truthful, it probably isn't at all valuable.
Right. The truthful words should come first. Like, I really think, I think there is something to, like, don't be afraid of it. Like, anytime you can feel in your gut, like, I'm not doing this because I'm afraid of it, because I feel like I'm going to look stupid. That's another big note.
Yeah.
Delaney, this is a Delaney note that I first 501 I was in. He was like, anytime that you're not committing or not joining in the fun, not stepping out from the back line, that's your ego. You are protecting your ego, protecting yourself. That's what that's about. You got to let go of your ego. So anytime that's coming from that place where you're like, I don't want to do that accent because I'll look stupid. I don't want to get on the floor and be like a dog because I'll look stupid. Like, shut up and get over it and just do it. But if you've gotten to the point where you're an advanced student and you're not playing that way anymore, like, you're really good, you don't play with fear. If it just doesn't feel truthful and feels like, yeah, I don't, that's not really how I make things funny.
Yeah.
Then I would say, like, don't force, like, that's not your comedic voice.
I think, and I say this to students sometimes, you need to know the difference between, like, discomfort and embarrassment.
Absolutely.
If something's like, if it's like, I feel stupid, that's embarrassment. Get over it. It's not relevant. If it feels wrong to you, if it makes you really uncomfortable, unsettled,
right.
don't do it. You don't have to do anything that makes you feel wrong.
If it feels wrong because you feel like I'm imitating someone else's style of play, or I'm being derivative because this didn't come from my head. This came from me being like, well, Timmy plays a lot of characters. Maybe mm-hmm. I should try one of his characters. Mm. Like, don't do that shit. You don't need to do that.
Yeah.
And coming from a person who is, I would say, one of the authorities on playing characters in improv and in sketch, to hear the note of...
That's an overstatement.
Well, I mean, this is my job, is to make overstatements. But, like, to hear from that, like, that isn't necessarily the most important thing. It's speaking through the truthful voice. I think that's incredibly useful, because it's not even something that I think about. And we've said mm-hmm. before, like, the note of, like, play more characters isn't the best note to give.
Yeah.
And I think that is the perfect sort of actual note to give. Just, like, mm-hmm. say what they would say. Don't worry about saying how they would say it.
Yeah.
Just be truthful as the character. That's, I think, incredibly useful.
Mm-hmm. So go forth. Good. Joanna Bradley, authority on characters, says don't play characters.
Thank you.
Don't.
That's,
please.
Let's write that down, Ben. That'll be in the description.
I don't want anyone competing with me. Come on.
That's true. You have to cut off the future generation before they really bloom.
That's right. Cut them off the knees.
Joanna, thank you so much for
sure
coming.
Sure thing.
This
thank
was
you guys.
An incredible. I'm sorry, Sagan.
No other questions?
I mean, there's so many, but they would be giant long tangents. You want me to ask one more?
I
want to
see them.
Okay, they're all over the place. We're going to. Really quickly,
Sean and I are just.
I just Joanna's
wait,
so
I
smart.
Asked about Seinfeld. I asked about. Oh, well, maybe these questions aren't going to be important, but we should ask hypotheticals then. Because these are all questions, stuff we covered.
Oh, okay.
Like stuff about Joanna, you know, her coming up in the community. Mm-hmm. That's what people ask most questions about.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I feel like I've asked all the questions I wanted to ask about characters. Do you have any others?
No, I just like Joanna.
I know.
We
I
can
mean,
just, but Nicole, we you have my number. We could just text and hang
no,
out.
But wait, I do want to, this might not be a thing we do right now, but I do want to sit down with some people that know stuff about law and talk about improv and law. Like, I really
like,
do.
You guys should teach that class again. Why don't you talk to Cassia?
Jesus. I mean, it's too late.
Too late.
She's fucking,
she's
too
dead?
Famous. Yeah. No, oh, she's okay. in LA now,
you
right?
You can't email her?
I mean, I could. You're
emails
right.
Emails don't go that far.
Yeah, they
oh,
don't
that's
go out
true.
To the,
you're right.
To the West Coast.
That's
be crazy.
True. They stop at the Allegheny.
Vomit of the street. Ladies and gentlemen.
Puke of the street, Sean.
Puke of the street.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Bad memory.
I have bad memory. Anyways, thank you so much for listening.
Sure,
Joanna, thank you for being our guest. This was an amazing episode. Guys, remember you can leave your questions and UCB at UCB Convos, and also my Twitter handle and Nicole's Twitter handle. It's all
no,
there.
Don't use my Twitter handle.
Don't tweet at Nicole, but tweet at me because I love it. Feed the nerds, and we'll see you next week. You've been listening to the UCB Long Form Conversation podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, go ahead and do that. And you can also go to iTunes and leave a rating or review. That would really help us out. In the future, if you want to ask us questions or ask questions to our guests, you can follow us on Twitter at UCB Convo and look for postings there on future guests and future activity. Guys, I'm feeding the nerds left and right. We'll see you next week.